ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Why do humans hold on to stuff? Oddments we don't use, and yet can't quite throw out. It's not just you and me. Australia's oldest library is crammed with stuff that isn't books. Terrible paintings, old menus, human hair. Is this history or hoarding? I'm Annabelle Crabb. Come and have a rummage through the story of us told by our stuff. Search for the History or Hoarding podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
However the Iran conflict ends, the consequences are in plain sight and rippling across the globe.
Fuel shortages, food insecurity, and the threat of a global recession. But is there an unexpected upside?
Could the war finally force the world to break its addiction to fossil fuels?
Or are we just trying to find a silver lining to a very dark cloud?
I'm Latika Berg.
And I'm Kylie Morris. Let's go roaming. So this episode, Latika, we wanted to reflect on the stalemate in the Middle East, but not so much in terms of the politics and the kind of strategic situation on the ground, but by considering the kinds of impacts that it's had in terms of the ensuing fuel crisis that's been felt around the world. Does this, could it usher in a new moment of possibility when it comes to considering alternative, cleaner and more independent energy sources?
Yes, Kylie, I'm reminded of that great line that Ursula von der Leyen, the EU Commission President, gave to the Australian Parliament when she was there in March, saying we're in a race to electrify our economies. I guess my question is really how sincere are politicians about seizing this moment? Because on one hand, I think this has opened up a huge space for people to say, look, we need to be energy resilient, but that means cutting off our dependence on new forms of energy supplies, which is, if you're a skeptic of climate change, you look at China and you say, well, look, they're the ones producing all the solar panels. They're the ones producing all the wind turbines. Let's not get ourselves into another situation of dependency. And so I think there's a lot of room at this buffet for everyone to pick and mix and take what they like. But overall, I do think the vibes certainly in Europe and the UK are we've got to get going with this renewable energy transition. I don't really understand why politicians have had to wait so long. Perhaps the economics are just still not stacking up.
Or perhaps they were waiting for popular opinion to change, right? If they needed a real nudge from the voting public that this is something that they want, that they need politicians to act on, well, maybe this is that moment. And when you think about the situation in Australia, even in the last month or so, right, in terms of EV sales, but also the conversations and investments in home batteries and solar panel installations, there's a lot. There's so much going on, I think, at an individual level, at a household level, when it comes to dealing with this. And I guess what we might be seeing more of now is pressure on the governments to try to introduce the next generation of solutions that might actually help the transition. And that's what I'm keen to hear about from our guest today.
Yes, we are welcoming to Global Roaming Dani Alexander. She's the Chief Executive of the University of New South Wales Energy Institute and the Interim CEO of the New South Wales Decarbonisation Innovation Hub. She joins us now. Dani Alexander, welcome to Global Roaming. Are there any silver linings to see in the big giant storm cloud that is geopolitics today?
I appreciate that it is a tense time for many people, both people who are looking at petrol prices going up, but also our global leaders that are having to take decisions now. The silver lining I see here is that there is an opportunity for us to take actions that we have wanted to for some time that are working towards our long-term strategy. This is an economic strategy, but of course also an environmental strategy as it relates to decarbonisation as well. In practice, I think what this actually means is that we now have the impetus to push through policies like electrifying as much as possible so we can put downward pressure on demand of oil and gas and make those investments in future technologies that we know we're going to need, like low carbon liquid fuels.
Danny, where's the room for change in this moment? Is it that the political calculation might have changed, right? So if you're a politician looking to make significant reforms longer term, right now, there could be a greater popular will for that change to actually happen.
That's right. In many ways, we've had an environmental imperative for decades, you know, having clear action on climate change to avoid those catastrophic effects. Now we have an economic imperative today to be able to solve these issues and promote what we would call sovereign energy solutions that are using our renewable energy resources that we have such abundance of here in Australia. So I do think there is a change here. There's an opportunity for our leaders to take this with both hands and really put forward the short-term tactics that can be in service of those long-term goals.
And yet, Danny, we have heard and seen multiple leaders or political leaders, even if they're not necessarily in power, say actually this moment presents us with the reason, the right reason, to go back to coal, to go back to fossil fuels, to go back to those things that we can dig up out of the ground and have our own energy sovereignty.
What I would say here is that when we're talking about expanding those fossil fuel-based resources, those are long-term investments. I'm not convinced, given the evidence, that they are going to address this short-term need that we have. And in that time frame, we could direct that investment into solutions that provide us that longer-term energy security because, you know, we're not going to run out of sunshine and we're not going to run out of wind.
So if you're looking for a brave step by a political leader to seize this opportunity, what would you want to see happen right now within Australia?
I would love to see a strong national approach to electrification to address this short-term constraint that we have emerging on the demand side. If we invest a lot into our electrification pathways, what we'll see is that we can save that oil and gas for those higher value uses for those that are going to struggle to take an electrification option. In practice, what that means is supporting the adoption of technologies like electric vehicles, also supporting our industry, which is our highest emitter, to be able to electrify, whether that's through supporting them through policy measures or programs, alongside other opportunities for communities to embrace the technology that we know works and we know is going to be able to benefit from the abundant sunshine, particularly that we have.
What do we have in the way of raw data, Danny? Where is the data showing the way, even in these last 2 to 3 months that the war in Iran has been raging?
What I keep coming back to is our primary energy consumption. And when we look at that, we see that 40% of that is oil. And this is what is creating the crisis. On the flip side, and why I keep coming back to electrification, is that we see our electricity system is now a bit more than 40% renewable energy. So this provides the impetus for us to shift away from the oil-based economy to an electric-based economy. We use the terminology around, you know, electrostates versus petrostates, and I'm not sure if it's a pure dichotomy like that. But I do think that those figures show that as we see more renewable energy generation coming onto our electricity system, that's the opportunity to bring home that energy sovereignty.
Can I ask you specifically about one example? So SAF, sustainable aviation fuel, it's been the big hope of aviation for more than a decade, I think, but it's always remained at premium and it's very, very expensive, more expensive than jet fuel. Is the cost that we're now seeing for jet fuel now at all outstripping that cost of SAF, or is it the case that SAF is still more expensive and that even with a great shock like today's, we're still not going to see those prices compete? Mm.
We are still some way away from having a cost comparative sustainable aviation fuel option to even with higher prices of aviation fuel. But what it does show is that we can make those investments to bring the technology cost curves down. You know, we have seen this across the board when we are looking at, say, solar panels. The costs before 20 years ago were maybe prohibitive for many consumers. Now, you know, you'd say that solar panels are probably one of the cheapest building materials, but you don't want to build your house out of solar panels for other reasons. But it's fantastic to see how much that innovation has driven down the cost. We probably need more time to be able to drive down the cost of sustainable aviation fuels, but there are technologies in the pipeline that are showing at a smaller scale and earlier stage that it could be possible.
Danny, Australian science has a reputation internationally, right, for true innovation and invention. There are lots of technologies that have been developed. We know we've seen lots of pilots around e-fuel, for example, and even biofuel development. But while the potential's there, we haven't seen successful scaling up of those technologies. So is this a moment when what's already on the shelf that hasn't been implemented might actually be applied more widely?
Absolutely. There is a requirement for government, industry, and academia to come together to be able to scale up quickly because it does take time. I'm calling in from New South Wales at the moment, and I've got a couple of examples of great technologies that I think are very prospective to drive up the efficiency, which of course drive down the cost of those technologies. The first is a technology that's coming out of a new company called Hysata, and this is actually related to hydrogen. This is a pathway that we know we need because some, again, sectors can't electrify. We need actually hydrogen molecules to be able to underpin industry now and into the future. But their technology that came out of the University of Wollongong has developed a new electrolyzer technology that has up to 95% system efficiency. And that what that will mean is that they'll be able to deliver the lowest cost of hydrogen ever. On the other side, something that's emerging through this crisis is, other chemicals that we require, like ammonia, for example. And another company called Plasmaleap that's come out of Sydney has done incredible work using plasma. It's called Plasmaleap. And they're using this plasma, which is, you know, we talk about as lightning in a bottle, as a catalyst that allows them to create renewable ammonia in a way that avoids high temperature and high pressure and large infrastructure. If they can do this in a modular way, they've got shipping containers out on farms looking to create that ammonia where it's needed, we'll be able to drive down the cost and actually have the alternatives for not just the fuels, but also the chemicals that are derived from these fossil-based sources up until now.
So how likely is it that this crisis becomes the catalyst that finally overcomes the kinds of barriers that those technologies have faced?
So I am acutely aware that in a week's time, we'll be looking at the next federal budget. And I do think there's an opportunity for the government, both at the federal but also at the state levels, to make this investment now. I also appreciate that there are a lot of pressures on making those additional investments, but it is crucial to be able to have those technologies in place in the future when we need them. You know, we have what's called the Future Made in Australia policy here, and under that, there's $250 million allocated to cleaner fuels. We'd be hoping to leverage that alongside, say, for instance, the portion that is allocated to sustainable aviation fuel, so around $33 million, to catalyze those new technology developments and scale them. You could probably imagine that $250 million is not going to build you a biorefinery, but really it's about allocating that resource strategically into promising technologies and then having something at the other side of that first investment that can, with industry, scale it. If I were to add one more point on this, if it is useful, I'd also reflect on the fact that over the past decade, as a portion of GDP, while we've seen an increase in investment in energy more broadly, what we've actually seen is that in energy research and development, that investment over the past years as a portion of GDP has halved. So this is something that we need to really consider if we're looking for those alternatives to liquid fuels that are fossil-based. And we'd hope to see that coming through with government's policies and programs.
You're listening to Global Roaming with me, Kylie Morris, and Latika Burke, and we're joined by the Chief Executive of the Energy Institute at the University of New South Wales, Denny Alexander.
Denny, how viable is a complete electrification of our economies for those who don't include nuclear in the mix? So I live in London, and Europe and the UK constantly talk about this. They're very pro switching from fossil fuels, but nuclear is at the heart of it, particularly SMRs, and they're trying to accelerate investment now into small modular reactors. Australia has chosen to ban nuclear energy, and it's just not contemplating it. Are the countries that don't have nuclear in their baseload mix, are they ultimately capable of getting there without relying on a fossil fuel transition energy like gas?
I would say yes. And there have been already examples in Australia where we have used over 70% of renewable resource to power our grid. In fact, South Australia runs totally on renewables some of the time. In fact, sometimes the state of South Australia runs completely off rooftop solar, which is incredible. It is an area which we are leading the world on, and I would encourage us to lean into that opportunity and show a pathway forward which is mostly powered by renewable generation. To your point about the mix, the projections that we see coming out of the market operator do suggest that we will likely still need a small portion of, in this case, gas-powered generation, maybe 5%. But it's shown that we can accommodate that while still meeting our emissions reduction target. Reflecting on nuclear specifically, I would just also be mindful of the timeframes that we're talking about here as well. You know, we really need to, as our government has suggested, get to 82% renewables by 2030. You know, that's less than 5 years away. If you look at the time horizons for not just overcoming those regulatory barriers, but also doing the development work and the build of those types of power stations, it's hard to see how that's going to line up with the pace by which we need our electricity sector to decarbonize.
Yeah, I hear that. But then I also hear people like you saying we're still a long way off from SAF.
Absolutely. And so what we would hope to do is to decarbonize our electricity sector as quickly as possible so that we can give ourselves or buy the time for ourselves to be able to decarbonize those harder to abate sectors like aviation. So we want to use that time to be able to develop those alternatives, say low carbon liquid fuel alternatives there, while using the technologies that we know we have available to us on the electricity side to do that as quickly as possible. When we look at the advice from the Climate Change Authority, they are suggesting that, yes, the heavy lifting on emissions reduction up until 2030, 2035 is done by the electricity and energy sector. But beyond that, actually, the biggest sector will be transport. So when it comes to timeframes, it's about using those policy levers to electrify as much as possible quickly, and then also making those investments so that when we get to 2030, when we get to 2035, and we need the transport sector to decarbonize, everything that's not electric has a viable technology alternative.
Denny, maybe this isn't exactly a silver lining, but there feels to be at least the potential for change in a positive direction coming out of this crisis. Reflecting on that, though, you know, the energy transition used to always be framed as an environmental issue or even a scientific issue. But now more often it's talked about in terms of national security. It's energy sovereignty, right? So how can emissions fall in an environment where there is more instability and more conflicts, feels to be, on a year-by-year basis?
Yes, it's really important in these times of crisis to reflect deeply on what it is we're trying to achieve in the long term. Perhaps maybe I can go to your point around silver linings. I do think there are some significant silver linings that we can use to underpin our economic prosperity as it relates to the energy transition. The first is that we have proven technologies that are at our fingertips that are not being deployed fast enough. We're well behind other countries when it comes to the deployment of electric vehicles, and we have the opportunity now to pull on those policy levers and speed that up. That's an easy win. We also have extraordinary ingenuity amongst our Australian innovators. I'm so lucky to be at UNSW, where earlier today I was just speaking to Professor Martin Green. He's the godfather of modern solar. We did that here, and we're doing more like that when it comes to some of the technologies that we're looking for, say in the cleaner fuel space. But the pressure is there. The pressure is absolutely there to make decisions and to alleviate the pressure on all of us as Australians. And I would encourage those that are making decisions at this point to have that longer-term view, but also take the opportunity that is here for them with both hands and undertake maybe some of the harder decisions that we know we need to make to be able to not just address emissions reduction, but set ourselves up in the best way for our future economic prosperity.
What are those harder decisions, Danny, and how much would they cost?
So we can talk about specific technology options, but I think that there are important decisions that we need to make as it pertains to transport and the electrification of transport. We've already seen some policy measures have great success in this space, say with the novated leasing option that's available that provides a cheaper electric vehicle for some. I think we can build on that rather than pull back from that in order to meet our targets for decarbonisation in the transport sector, but also shore up the what we would call the fuel supply, which will be electricity into the future.
Last week, there was a massive conference in Colombia all about transitioning away from fossil fuels, right? Lots of countries were represented, including Australia. And those talks were in part a reflection of the failures of decades of annual COPs and COPs not achieving what many member states hoped they might. Was Colombia a ground zero moment for you in the push to ditch fossil fuels?
It's a conversation we've been having for a long time, is how we can transition away from fossil fuels. So personally, I was delighted to see this coalition of the willing coming together to put forward solutions that are practical, that we can all work on together. I also liked how it's been framed as a complementary measure alongside the COP structure. And, you know, I see them working together, particularly in this opportunity we have as Australia and with our partners in the Pacific for COP31. Areas that I do think that we can take a leadership role in is this global push towards electrification. And I have colleagues that are working really hard in the background to make that happen and make progress both in that meeting in Colombia, but also in COP31 as well. I would just say now we do have this opportunity. The spotlight is on us to show what we can do. And we have brilliant examples that we can share with the world, like what is happening in South Australia, like I mentioned earlier. We are a smaller country, yes, but we are also very mighty in what we can do. We really punch above our weight when it comes to technology innovation. And there are many spaces in the energy transition or transitioning away from fossil fuels where the world is looking to us to champion different pathways and also test solutions that they're not ready for quite yet. If I were to give a specific example of that, which is useful, I think the deep integration of variable renewable energy sources is something where we are leading the world, and being able to show how we can provide not just reliable power, so supply equaling demand, but also security of supply. This is something that comes up a lot, particularly with recent events, say in the Iberian Peninsula, where they had that countrywide blackout. We're doing a lot of work here with our market operator, but also in academia to support solutions that can deliver security of supply with very high levels of what we would call inverter-based resources, essentially those solar and wind generators and the batteries that support them are connected by inverters to the grid.
Back on COP, that split presidency, do you not see that will potentially split momentum for the Pacific at all?
I must confess that coming from the Energy Institute at the university, you know, my work is more on the technology pathways and also some of the policy pathways that can support that rather than commenting on the broader political economy. But what I would say is that we have an extraordinary opportunity here to support our Pacific partners as well with their decarbonisation journey. We've been working with our partners closely here in Australia, but also in countries in the Pacific to show how we can decarbonize in different contexts, and they are vastly different contexts. Together, this is an opportunity for us in COP31 to show what that looks like for us at Australia, but also in a different context with Pacific nations. And you know, I'm really excited to see how that comes to fruition.
Dani Alexander, thank you for joining Global Roaming.
Thank you for having me.
Latika, what I heard in that conversation with Dani is that with these challenges come opportunities, right? Not to be glibly optimistic, but perhaps this is a time of potential change that no one saw coming. And those technology pathways that are already there that Dani described so articulately can actually now be further developed and potentially scaled up.
Yes, I agree. But to some extent, it is the same case when I look around at what all the political leaders who are addressing this challenge are saying. You have, I think, a bit of a split divergence on this. You have Europeans saying we're not going to abandon our energy targets. But I do think in other jurisdictions you have a more laissez-faire approach. And I think there's a political climate of okayness now to even discuss going back to fossil fuels, using it as a crutch to get to the transition. And I do think that changes the game just somewhat. And I think the upcoming COP will be a good example of that. I mean, we're not going to see the major players there. So I think it's very hard when you have one of the world's leading economies saying, drill, baby, drill. And by the way, we might punish you if you don't get drill, baby, drill going in your own countries. It does just open space for those who have always argued against renewable transition or the energy transition to slow it down.
Yeah, but I wonder, are we seeing the opposite pressure on the street here in Australia, where there is changing opinion or perhaps a recognition at least that fossil fuels in the form of very expensive petrol is a major problem? Not being able to access adequate supply is a major problem. And in that climate, it's so much easier to say, look, we do need to reduce our dependence on these fuels.
Yeah, for sure. Although I thought that point she made about the electric charging infrastructure being so salient, that is something I have observed for at least a decade, just how rapidly ahead the UK particularly and Europe is on some of these questions. And Australia's playing catch up, but maybe one of the most expensive times possible.
Yeah, maybe so. But then I guess now that we have so many electric cars being sold, even in the past few weeks, perhaps there's suddenly new pressure, right, on the government to sort that out. Now, don't forget to write to us. We love your questions and feedback. Actually, we've had so many comments around energy and renewables and whether or not the Iran war may have this unexpected outcome that has pretty much led to why we had the conversation you just heard. So we are listening. Please keep it coming. Our email is global.roaming@abc.net.au.
Thanks to our producer, Aston Brown. Hamish and Geraldine will be back tomorrow and are headed to, of all places, a warehouse in Sydney to take a deep dive on the rapid development of military drone technology. I'm personally very keen for that one. See you later.
See you.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.